I want to invite you to open up your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes 3, and I'm going to read verses 16 down through chapter 4. And I've put in the bulletin that we're going to read to verse 3, but I think I'll go all the way down to verse 12 this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, starting at verse 16. So he's just said, "For everything there is a season and a time and matter under heaven." And now the wise teacher says, "Moreover," verse 16, "I saw under the sun that in the place of justice even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them that they may see themselves and are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts are the same. One dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is a vapor. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? So I saw that there's nothing better than for a man to rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Again, I saw all the oppression that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead are more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. I saw all the toil and the skill and the work that came from man's envy of his neighbor, and this also is a mist and a striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh, but better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after the wind. Again, I saw the futility under the sun. One person has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is a mist and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have good reward for their toil, for if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has no one else to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." When the story broke this week, the public response was swift and loud, as it rightfully and ought to be. Following up on a potential lead, Radio-Canada discovered something had been occurring in the Val-d'Or region. Aboriginal women were coming forward with stories of abuse against provincial police officers. Women told the news agency that officers routinely picked up women who looked or appeared to be intoxicated and would drive them out into the country, especially in the winter, leaving them there for themselves. Some alleged that they were either physically or sexually assaulted, and 8 officers who have been accused are under investigation. The sad reality of situations like these are that we hear horrors and evils like this all too often. The abuse of power, it happens. It happens with police officers. It happens in the courts. It happens with lawyers. It happens with school officials, medical professionals, even religious professionals. It happens everywhere. The abuse is all around us. While justice is intended to be blind, there is this seeming sense that misjustice is not as blind as it seems. And it's right and proper, and it ought to be denounced when people abuse power. It needs to be said loud and clear. The flood of abuse cases, I think, can cause us as human beings to grow weary. What can one person like me do? I feel a sense of powerlessness, a helplessness, an inability. I can grow in weariness or despair, thinking nothing can ever be done. Still others work so hard and they get in the public sphere and they work saying, I will work so this never happens again, so that no one else suffers like this person suffered. And the injustice continues. It doesn't stop, even though someone says, I will work and do everything possible. So if we can't stop injustice, should we just resign ourselves to the fact that, well, justice won't be? Or do we try to fight injustice with the possibility that we might make a little dent here in this corner of the earth or somewhere else, but knowing that opening the door to dealing with one injustice might actually open a floodgate of injustices that we're not ready and prepared to deal with and face? The wisdom of Ecclesiastes tells us that resigning ourselves to the fact that there is always injustice, or trying to work ourselves to death to stop injustice, is not a good option. Rather, the wise sage, he wants us to help us to see. In fact, if you start at verse 10, this is of chapter 3, this is what the wise sage of Ecclesiastes says. He says, I saw, verse 10. Verse 12, I saw. I perceived, verse 15. I saw, moreover, I saw, verse 16. Chapter 4, I saw. He keeps seeing things over and over and over. He can't help but look in the world and see. He sees that there's injustice. And in these verses, he helps us to see three things. That we have to wait for justice, we have to live in light of the end, and that we have to work with others. So I want us to see this morning that even though we live in a world where there will always be poverty and there will always be injustice, it does not mean inactivity or resignation or relinquishing our responsibility, but rather it means that we do have certain responsibilities that God has put before us. First, we wait for justice. Look at verses 16 and 17 with me. He says, moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. From verse 10, we're told that this wise sage has been seeing all of these things. And now he sees that in the very place where justice ought to happen, whether it's with the police, whether it's with the courts, whether it's in the religious sphere of life, regardless, power is being abused. Unrighteous acts abound. Now, that's not to say that we ought to give up on the law courts or the police or religious institutions or medical professionals, but the news alone can make us despair. And if you read Ecclesiastes, as many people have tried to do through the eyes of a skeptic, I think that this passage only leaves you with despair. What do I do in a world of injustice? You would wonder if there's any hope for humanity under the sun. Luther said that the main problem here is not that there is wickedness, but rather that there is wickedness that occurs in the place of justice, and it can't be corrected. You can't correct it because the people who have power are the ones who cause the problem. And if you're powerless, what do you do? If you're an Aboriginal woman in Val-d'Or, Quebec, what do you do? But there is a way to deal with injustice. For most of us, dealing with injustice, if we're going to be really honest, Christians can tend to be a little superficial. We have slogans, and we repeat those slogans over and over. They're often true, and they're well-informed, but we say things like this. We'll say things like, well, it'll all work out in the end, or God has some reason for this, and that may be true. But is it helpful? It may be true that God will sort all things out in the end. But if you're an employee who has suffered termination because of wrongful dismissal, if you're a patient who has been ignored and has not been treated in an old age institution, if you are a person who suffers, these statements do not help you. These pious statements are well-intentioned, but they are very poorly timed. And what you need to be able to do is to be able to hold on to a confession of faith when the fog is thick. But not just faith in general, not some foggy notion of faith and sound pious. Rather, you have to have faith like the wise sage who says in verse 17, I said in my heart, he's talking to himself, he's reminding himself of truths. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time for every matter and every work. As much as the Old Testament has this slim and narrow view of what happens after death, it is there. And it comes up even in a passage like this. Here in the verses to follow, there's more than just a sense that we'll die and that God will fix things in the future, but rather, there is this sense in which it is all in due time. Both the New International Version and the English Standard Version, as they translate verse 16, they begin it with the word, moreover. It's a pointing back to what's just preceded in the verses from verses 1 through 15. Moreover what? What we learned in chapter 3, verses 1 through 15, is that God's in control of all of history from beginning to end, and that there are plans and purposes that we don't understand. That there's a time for everything under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time for war and a time for peace. There is this time where everything happens under the sun, and we do not perceive why God does what he does, but it does happen, and God is in control. And our confession of faith is that we do not see and we do not understand, but we believe that judgment will come, and we believe by faith that every wrong will be righted. Now it begs the question that though we see through a glass dimly, and though we do not understand, is justice delayed, justice denied? No, it is driving in the fog. We don't see clearly now, but we believe that the road ahead will be straightened. We believe that God will right every wrong. And it helps us for several reasons. It helps us that in this world we can work for right. We can do what is just. We can love what is merciful. We can walk humbly before God. We believe these things to be true because if God will judge all things, do I have to get revenge? Is it my responsibility to act in vengeance then towards those who have done wrong? Yes, the courts ought to be used. Yes, every legal recourse needs to be taken advantage of when there are people who abuse power and need power brought to be disciplined to be brought to them. But God will deal with every injustice, and he will right every wrong. And then it frees me in several ways to do several things. If God will act justly, look at what God's justice in the future allows me to do. One, it allows me in this present age to forgive. It allows me then to be able to say, I will forgive those who have done wrong to me or who have done wrong to others. Secondly, it helps me to pray for mercy. It helps me to pray that God would not just act in justice, but rather that if I have been part of the problem and God has been kind to show me mercy, I pray that others will receive mercy. So I can forgive, I can pray for mercy, and the final thing is, I can believe, even though I have no empirical evidence in front of me, that God isn't ignorant. Nothing happens apart from his knowledge. We don't understand why he allows it to happen. But who am I to stand in the place and judge God and tell him how things ought to be? For if he were to deal with evil in every part of the universe, wouldn't it have to start in my own heart? And if he deals with justice that's in and the wickedness that starts even in my own heart, well, I want justice for everyone else, but do I really want it for me? You see, as a Christian, believing that God will act justly in the very end and the last time frees me to say, God, help me to pray for forgiveness and for mercy, that you're not ignorant of these things, and have mercy on me. But for the grace of God go I. We've heard that saying so often. We wait for justice. We don't know what God is doing. And to stand in judgment of God is just to expose the evil in our own hearts. So we wait for justice. And second of all, we live in light of the end. Look at verses 18 and following. He says, I said in my heart with regard to the children of Adam that God is testing them that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts are the same. As one dies, so the other. They all have the same breath. And man has no advantage over the beast, for all is a fleeting breath. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? You have to admit that these verses are strange. We have trouble with them in part because if you know a little bit of the Bible, you read these and you go, this doesn't make sense with the rest of the Bible. But what Ecclesiastes is not saying, let me be clear, it's not saying here that we are some sort of evolved primate that is a little bit better than the beasts, but that we're the same as the beasts. That's not the point. If you want to read that into the text, that's you imposing it on the text. Elsewhere, the psalmist, for example, Psalm 8 tells us that God has made us a little lower than the angels, and yet he's crowned us with glory and honor. Yet we do not experience the rule over creation that we ought to have. But we are from the earth, and from the earth we were made, and to the earth we will return. Genesis 3:19 says that by the sweat of our face we'll eat bread till we return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. So we're all going to die just like the beasts. That's the point. Beasts die, humans die. We all die. And he tells us in verse 18, I said in my heart with regard to the children of Adam that God is testing them that they may see themselves but that they are but beasts. So why is justice delayed? We die like beasts because we act beastly. Ever since the beginning in the garden, we strove to obtain that which we could not grab onto. And rather than becoming godlike, we became like beasts. The very animals that we were to have dominion over, we ended up acting just like them. Cynthia Heimel once wrote these telling words. She said, "The minute a person becomes a celebrity is the same minute he or she becomes a monster." Let's just take a local example of what happens. A young teen from Stratford is discovered on YouTube. He is great and pushed into fame. He becomes a prominent singer who has cool clothes and sells lots of music and behaves badly. He suddenly has all of the things that he never had living with a single mom in Stratford. He couldn't make it a go until someone found his YouTube video and his amazing singing. And then they propel him into the spotlight. And what does he do when he finally has power, fame, notoriety? He behaves like a beast. He behaves like a beast, reaching godlike status only to become a monster. So is there any advantage that God delays justice? Is Justin Bieber our future? We have to read the rest of the Bible. It does not stop with Ecclesiastes. And as Christians, we know more than what Ecclesiastes tells us. Not because we're so smart, but because God has revealed to us graciously his plan from beginning to end. We know from 1 Peter chapter 2 what God has said. God has said that, for this is a gracious thing, that when mindful of God, one can endure sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to you this has been given. For to you this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his footsteps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his, that's being Christ's, mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. God delays his justice. You see, so that we would learn our creaturely existence, that we are not infinite but finite. We are not all-knowing, but we are limited. And if we live in light of the end, will we not remember that we will suffer in this life, that we will experience injustice, that there will be difficulties done to us? We ought to purposefully live here and now. This is the point of verse 22. So I saw that there's nothing better for a man to do than he should rejoice in his work, for that's his lot. We ought to work. This is the place and time that God has given to us. He will sort everything out in the end. All wrongs will be righted. But we live in light of the end, believing that the end makes us effective now. So, if we wait for justice and we live in light of the end, then we need help. We need help so that we can live and work purposefully with others. Look at chapter 4, verses 1 through, well, the following verses. He says, "Again, I saw all the oppression that is done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, no one's there to comfort them. On the side of the oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead were more fortunate than the living are more fortunate than the living who are all still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are under the sun. Then I saw all the toil and all the skill and the work that comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is a mist and an unhappy business. For two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." If you work against injustice, and it abounds all around you, and you feel like you are powerless and helpless and unable to make any difference, what's going to happen? Aren't you going to feel like, I have no power, I have no ability to change the situation, so I just end up in resignation to the fact that what will be? You see, this is where, as the wise sage says in verses 1 through 3, if that's the case, then it's better than to have never existed. The person who suffers, well, if they're powerless and they have no ability to change anything, then wouldn't you rather have never existed? This is very much what Job said when all of his belongings and possessions and his children were lost and destroyed, that he would rather curse the day that he was born. Or the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah 20, when he sees the wickedness abounding around him, and as he prophesies against the evil, he says, "Cursed be the day that I was born." Or Elijah, who sees a wicked king in power, who looks at the evil of his nation, who can't change anything, though he prophesies and speaks to it. He says, "I and I alone am left," and runs into the wilderness as though he's ready to die in 1 Kings 19. But what if, what if there are more people than just you? What if you have not been left alone? What if, like Elijah, God has preserved a people who will stand for justice, who will work for it? You're not alone. You see, Elijah, when he was out in the wilderness feeling like the kings could just destroy his life and that he was on the run and he would die, he cried out to the Lord, "I and I alone am left. All the rest have bowed their knees to the evil god Baal, and there is no hope in this land." But what does the Lord reply? "I have preserved a remnant for you, I have kept a people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. This is what Paul says in Romans 10 and 11. He looks at the example in Romans 11 of Elijah, and he says, God does not leave you alone. Ecclesiastes picks up on this as well. You are not alone, though it might feel like it'd be better if I was just dead. The reality is that God works by his Spirit to convict his people of all truth and righteousness. Where do human rights come from in the first place? Where do we get this sense of what is right and wrong? How can we have human rights if we don't know where they come from? Are they arbitrarily picked? What makes having clean water a human right? What makes equality a human right? How do we know that these things are rights? Unless you know that there is a God and that we are made equal under God, all in his image, you have no foundation for human rights. The whole discussion is such a foolish discussion because you have no foundation, no grounding to think about human rights. The very essence of human rights is grounded in the Judeo-Christian ethic of understanding that all people are made in the image of God. And if that's the case, then that the sense of rightness and wrongness is not arbitrarily chosen. It's not by the cultural winds that blow. It's not that morality shifts and changes. It's rather understood that there is a God who has spoken an eternal law, and that all laws ought to be derived from the very lawgiver of God himself. This is where justice derives itself from. This is the foundation. Which is why then, if you believe that there is a God who has made humanity in his image, and that there is a moral right and a moral wrong, that there is a good and a true and a beautiful, and that it is not merely a subjective taste, then you need to know that God has given other people this conviction as well. As the writer of Hebrews says, don't grow weary, but rather encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. Gather together. We gather for this reason. We have to lift our eyes off of what happens horizontally, because what we see on this plane will so often cause us to be discouraged and to despair and to give up. But if we can lift our eyes and see that there is a lawgiver who is just and right and true, and that there are other people who walk in light of this God who has revealed himself, well, then we can deal with the injustices. We don't stop meeting together. There is a day coming where the last will be first, where the hungry and thirsty will be filled, and all who need a home will find rest for their heads. There is a day of celebration. And we can say this because, like the wise sage, we have a confession of faith that we hold on to, that we don't waver from. Look back at verse 22. So I saw that there is nothing better. This is chapter 3, verse 22. So I saw that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? We can work. We can work hard. We can enjoy our work. Why? Because of the last phrase of verse 22. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Anybody in this room able to see what will come after you? What your work will produce? No. But we know that our lives and the effects of our lives will carry on. That people will pick up and build off of the things and the knowledge that we have discovered or learned or shared or passed on. But we know that the story of the Bible, it carries on. And it tells us that there is someone who can show us and bring us to see what will be after us. The one who actually experienced the greatest injustice of all time. A man who had done no wrong. A man who was innocent and yet was charged with political insurrection. A man who was seen as a traitor. A man who was seen to be a troublemaker. A man who was tortured and beaten. A man who was ultimately crucified and killed. A man whose name is Jesus. This is the greatest act of injustice. An innocent man condemned to die, killed. But our confession of faith as Christians is something that Christians have confessed for 2,000 years with consistency and clarity, with eyewitness testimony. that Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead, that he has conquered death, he has defeated sin, and hell has been subjected to him and has been overcome. And if this is the reason that we have hope, it is that there is resurrection hope. For Peter writes, and he says, if we go back to 1 Peter, "For this too you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he continued," this is the key, "he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed." Friends, this is the hope that we have, that the resurrection is true, and that Christ has suffered once and unjustly treated, and unjustly, though he was treated wrongly, he did not open his mouth, he did not seek revenge, but he rather prayed from the very cross, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." In a world of death, in a culture of death, there needs to be the essence of life, which begins with the essence of the very message of Jesus. He is first and foremost our example because he suffered and died for us. All condemnation now, no dread. Jesus and all in him is mine, alive in him, the living head, and clothed in righteousness divine. Bold I approach the eternal throne and lay hold of the crown through Christ my own. Did we not sing that this morning? Is it true? The resurrection is true. He has suffered and died and been raised to life. And this week, we will do one of the most bizarre things in our culture. Kids will go around and knock on doors, and they will ask for candy from strangers. We'll put up gravestones in our yards, and we'll hang skeletons from trees, and there'll be knives stuck into bodies, and we'll think that this is all normal. But what does the motivation of death cause? Doesn't it cause a sense of dread and fear, uncertainty, gloom? Don't we have to treat it with a trivial sense because we can't come to grips with our own morality or mortality? We can't face our own end? But if we live in light of the fact that there is a God who has raised the dead, and we believe and we confess this, then the condemnation that we feel because of our powerlessness, it has been dealt with by the resurrection. As Paul says in Romans 4:25, you have been justified by his resurrection. That we are justified, death, injustice, suffering will not prevail. Christ is our example because he is first our substitute. He has removed the guilt and shame, and he has caused us to live for this hope. So, if that's true, if Christ has been raised from the dead, then what's the worst that anybody could do against me in this present age? If I'm a minority and I have no power and influence, what a difference. What can separate me from his love? Neither height nor depth, neither angels nor demons, principalities or powers, the present or the future, nor anything else in all of creation can separate me from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus my Lord. So if that's the case, am I afraid of getting AIDS because I work with someone who has AIDS as a medical professional? Am I going to stop being a police officer who works with integrity and stopping the criminal? No. Am I going to act justly as a lawyer, even defending the hardest cases because I believe that every case needs justice? Will I work with integrity in my business every day, doing my transactions in such a way that it honors God and pleases him, and that every customer is treated fairly and given the best product that I can give them? If the resurrection is true, then all of these things inform how I live. So do you believe this? This truth will sustain you in living and working for right in a world of wrong. Christ is risen. He's risen indeed. Lord, we pray, let the resurrection motivate us. If we're the only ones left, if we were to be the only ones left standing, if no one else would say evil is evil, when people say evil is good, Let us not fear death itself. We can live in light of the end. We can work for justice because Jesus Christ has been raised. And that's why even now we can sing, Christ is risen. He's risen indeed.